Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
Today's episode is sponsored by HP, the leader in world's most secure manageable PCs. Learn about HP's healthcare edition products at hp.com/go/healthcare/US. And this week, I'm delighted to be joined again by my good friend, Craig Joseph. He is the chief medical officer with AVAP, and we're talking about current issues. And Craig, anything that comes to mind for you in terms of current issues?
Well, Dr. Nick, as you know, I spend a good part of my time in the hospital in Northern California. And no, there are no issues of importance that anyone's working on.
With the exception of one thing, right?
What is that? I don't really know to what you are referring.
Oh, good Lord. Coronavirus or COVID-19.
Oh, the novel coronavirus. You mention it, it has been taking up some of my time.
It has. In so many ways. So why don't we start? You're a experienced physician. You've had clinical practice. I think people are hungry for some real information, real insights. Tell us your sort of thoughts in a brief way. How do you see this particular virus? How does it relate to other viruses like the flu that people talk about? And what should people be thinking today about this coronavirus or COVID-19, as it's called?
Yeah. So, what I've been telling people for 2 or 3 weeks now is when they say, should I be worried? I say, well, the only people I know who are really worried, and I wouldn't say freaking out, but really paying a lot of attention, are physicians. And so since physicians are the only big group of people who are really kind of very worried about this, that's probably a good sign that everyone else should be worried about it. Everything seems to, the more things stay the same, the more they change, or something along those lines. So information seems to be changing, daily about, from a clinical standpoint, what we had heard when this was mostly in China, that this was a disease like a serious cold for 80% of the folks who got it. And 10% or so, 15% had serious side effects from it. And then, mm-hmm. 1 or 2%, meaning serious, meaning ending up in the hospital, needing some kind of support, either oxygen or needing to be connected to a ventilator and needing a lot of, medication support. And 1 or 2% died, right? And this is what we had been hearing for a couple weeks now, I think, from China. If you compare that to the flu, the typical seasonal flu that we see here, our fatality rate's about 0.1%. So 1/10 of 1%. And now we're talking about 1 to 2%, which is 10 to 20 times, right? So anyone that thinks that this is like the flu, of course, that is nothing like the flu. And the reason for this is that we used to call this the novel, and we still do, the novel coronavirus. Novel meaning new. No one had seen this before. No one has immunity to this at this point, unless you've gotten it. Which is different again than the flu. Almost all of us have gotten the flu from one time or another, and the flu virus does mutate and change from season to season, but we're always a little bit protected. If we get the flu shot, as we should every year, we're even more protected against the flu signs and symptoms. So this is not a disease to be ignored or to be played down. It's very serious. The other thing that we had heard from China was that this is really serious for those elderly, and that's been defined somewhere between 50 and 65 or older, and folks with chronic medical problems like diabetes or lung problems, COPD or emphysema, those kinds of patients. Any patient who's on an immunosuppressant, that could be anything from an arthritis medication to a skin medication. Those patients are really at high risk. Now, seemingly every day, I'm reading more and more that this is, those groups are definitely at high risk. Elderly patients with chronic medical problems. However, young folks, and again, I'm thinking 20 to 50, are not out of the woods, and a not insignificant number of them are having serious problems. There was an emergency room doctor who I think was 45 or 50 who who died in Washington State as a direct result of caring for patients. And so I don't know, unless you're 10 years old, I'm not sure that this is a benign occurrence. We have no reason, no one seems to understand why kids, I'm a pediatrician, no one seems to understand why kids are not seemingly adversely affected.
Yeah, that is a little bit unusual for these viruses, right? Normally, it hits everybody, albeit in various forms.
Yeah, when you look at like the flu, it's bimodal, right? You see, you see two kind of groups of people that are affected negatively with a regular flu. That would be young kids who don't really have any immunity, and older people who used to have immunity but have lost it just because their body's not making antibodies as well anymore. So this doesn't seem to be that. This seems to be mostly older people. And folks with chronic medical problems. So I don't know. We don't have an explanation for that, but thank God.
The other thing that I've seen that we just don't have an explanation for, and is clearly very troubling, not because I'm on the front line, because I'm not, although I'm willing, but all of my colleagues are, is that this is hitting clinical professionals much harder, even if you normalize for age and other chronic conditions. So those on the front line, maybe because they're exposed to higher viral loads, because they're not getting the protective equipment, we really don't know, but we saw the data in China suggests that those frontline staff, clinical staff, get this disease at a higher rate than you would expect based on their age, gender, you know, general health, which is extraordinarily troubling, because that essentially will damage our capacity to treat these patients if those folks are taken out of commission and unwell and having to be treated themselves.
Oh, absolutely. And we haven't even talked about supply chain. Many physicians and nurses, respiratory techs and therapists have been taken out of circulation because they've been exposed, and we don't have enough testing kits to test. So if someone's been in the same room or been around one of these folks, either a patient or a colleague, they're home for 14 days. And that means they can't see patients, even if they're feeling great.
Right.
And so because we're still, to this day that we're recording this, we still don't have anywhere close to the number of tests that we need. And that's, and you can read about it, even in New York, places where they're really feeling it. They can't test people. And so it's seemingly, unless you're either an NBA player, and don't get me started on that, or you're a clinician nowadays, or you need to be in the hospital, you're not getting a test. Either if you're not sick enough to be hospitalized, which again, the vast majority of patients who get COVID-19 are not going to be sick enough to be hospitalized, that your job is to go home and spend 14 days by yourself. And that doesn't mean hanging out with your family. That means trying to be as far away from your family as possible. Yeah. So that is a problem. So A, clinicians are getting sick, and B, clinicians are being sidelined, even if they're not sick.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because I know you're experienced in terms of analysis, informatics, you understand this. And this issue of known and unknown is incredibly important, because that essentially represents the denominator in terms of any of these percentages that we offer of the number of people infected, the number of people that get serious disease versus mild disease. And importantly, the one that people always snap back to, which is the mortality rate or fatality, which, as you described, 1-2%. We've seen much higher in Italy, for example, rising as high as 5-6%, which, you know, the population leans a little bit older, but that can't explain that exclusively. And there are lots of things contributing. But if you don't know what the total number is, you really are not estimating. So we're not testing any sense of where that number of total patients is, irrespective of what we know for sure based on the tests that have been applied to date. And I'm trying to think what the number was for the US. I know we were in the 200,000s worldwide at this point. I know it's going up, but where is that? What's the multiplier?
So certainly neither you or I are infectious disease experts or epidemiologists. However, reading what they're saying, is that at least again, as of the day we're recording this, they're saying, I've heard, hey, take the total number of positives that we have in the US and easily multiply it by 10. And so that seems to be the multiplier that we're going with. This is a guess. And it's, of course, preposterous. And I could sit and scream at you for 20 minutes about how crazy it is that we don't know that what the denominator is. But yeah, so however many we have as positives, we should probably multiply that by 10 to give us a probably conservative estimate as to how many patients actually have it. And really to know, being held up as the paragon of handling this seems to be South Korea, where exactly. anyone could be tested. And so again, if you're only testing people that come to the doctor, because I mean, let's take this back a step. If you call your doctor's office and say, hey, I've got a cough and a low grade fever, but I'm otherwise feeling fine. I suggest that most likely the answer you're going to get is stay in your room for 14 days, right? Oh, but how do I find out if I have COVID-19 or not? You don't. You might have it. You might not have it. We're not going to do anything for you one way or the other, except treat you symptomatically, which you don't need us to do. Now, if you've got a super high fever or if you're having trouble breathing, then yes, you're going to need to be evaluated. And those are the people that are going to get the test. But what, again, South Korea has done, and apparently China to some extent, is to say anyone that's worried, come on down. And then now you're getting an actual sense of what the attack rates are, because there's plenty of people walking around who feel great and have no symptoms whatsoever and are positive. We know that. We know a bunch of people, significant chunk of people who get this disease have no right. clue they got it. And they would deny it in court, as well they should, right? But we stuck a Q-tip up their nose and it came back positive. So without doing that, hard to know.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Incrementalist and News You Can Use. And today's episode is sponsored by HP, the leader in the world's most secure and manageable PCs. Learn more about HP's Healthcare Edition products at hp.com/go/healthcare/US. And be sure to follow the company on Twitter at HP. We were just talking about testing in South Korea, and I wanted to highlight something that I saw there. And, you know, it comes back to this issue of the exposure and, you know, the enormous gratitude that we owe to the frontline clinical staff who are doing the testing, treating, all of those things worldwide. And I saw they have stood up what are essentially are telephone booths that have glass interactions. Patients are on the other side, and there is no physical contact between the testing person and the individual being tested. And, you know, we see these drive-through ideas. I think they've even come to the US. I think those are good, but it's still a sort of temporary barrier. People are wearing their protective equipment. But that's part of the problem, is that you've really got to get close to the individual to take that sample from the back of the throat or the back of the nose. And there's some operator challenges with that, which is why the sensitivity of this test is, as I understand it, it can be as low as 60%. So we're not picking up all of them. So we're missing some that maybe have it because we didn't actually get the sample that had the virus in. But they've done this astounding job. And quickly too, why are they so much better? Any thoughts on why they're doing such a good job?
I have thoughts, but it's probably best not to share them, except to say that they, as a country, took this very seriously. And I think if you look back, there's probably a reason, right?
Right.
They actually hit. There's a word that I try not to use, but SARS. SARS.
But that's exactly right.
Right. And so, again, some people confuse when you say that, you say, oh, is that the coronavirus? Well, it's a coronavirus, but it's right. not the one we're talking about. Even though the one we're talking about now, the one scientific name for it does begin with those letters, SARS. But so they've had infections and epidemics in their country, and they've seen what happens. And thank God we have not. We've certainly had epidemics, the last big, you know, pandemic, 1918. With the influenza that probably didn't originate in Spain, but it's got the name anyway. So they kind of ramped up. And that, I think that was a big thing that I've been reading about in the last 24 hours or so, that South Korea and the United States both identified their first patient with this novel coronavirus on the same day. So the same day they figured out that they had a patient, we figured out we had a patient. Yet, big difference in response. And so
right.
we certainly have... we in the United States have shown what happens when you don't prepare the way that you should have. And again, I'm gonna go with this reference to the TV show on PBS called This Old House, where they take apart houses and they put them back together again. And yeah. There's a plumber there who always rails against people who say, hey, there's this kind of expensive thing we need to do behind the wall here that will make it safer and more efficient and cost some X number of dollars now, but will return over the next 20 years. No one wants to do that because they can't see it because it's behind the wall. Right. And that's, I think, what we're getting as what we've done as a country is to say, well, pandemic planning, kind of boring, usually doesn't happen, costs a lot of money. A lot of people are working on something that we may never see the fruits of their labor. Why would we pay money for all of that? And now we're finding out why. And hopefully it will change the way we approach kind of that preventative concept of kind of putting a lot of money there and then praying to God we never, you know, that would be the kind of money you'd spend and pray you never need the return on investment. Pray right. that you've wasted that money. Because that means you've never had a pandemic.
And I think in part because, you know, they were close to it. They're very exposed. You know, maybe they're just more sensitized. It's a bit like our whole desire for, you know, giving people vaccines. If you sensitize them, then they react better the next time around. So they've been vaccinated against this whole pandemic because they had a much more serious sort of approach. But I like to try. I have to admit, it's been a lot harder in the last few days, weeks, to be as positive as I can and find some of the good news in here. You know, talk a little bit about that. And, you know, from my perspective, I'll pick a couple of things. One, wow, all the telehealth barriers disappear. Poof, overnight. We've suddenly, gosh, if you know medicine in California and you know medicine in Maryland, you can treat patients. It doesn't matter. I have to believe it's going to be hard to walk some of this stuff back. I think there are some other examples. MIPS was another one. You want to talk about that?
Sure. And you know, what we're talking about is regulatory barriers that have been put up to practice medicine in the United States. And you and I are, and many, many physicians are, think that many of those regulatory barriers actually don't make any sense. And so the one you just right. mentioned is every state gets to license its physicians in its own way, meaning if I'm licensed to practice in Michigan, I cannot cross the line into Indiana and then see a patient in the past. And what you're asking about now, MIPS, or what formerly was known as meaningful use, this was money that about 12 years ago, last time we had the Great Recession, some money was thrown at hospitals and doctors to try to encourage them to use technology and electronic health records and that kind of thing. And of course, it makes sense that if the government's going to give hospitals and doctors money to use technology, they want them to use it efficiently and effectively and not just check a box and get a lot of money back. And so the government made certain rules to say, hey, the technology has to do this, you have to do it in that way. And I'll give them an A for effort, but not such good grades for helpfulness, meaning doctors are being graded and rated and receiving money or getting money held back based on criteria that probably don't make a lot of sense to most of us. So some of, I could come up with like specific examples of, hey, you know, did you check the allergies for a patient? That's an important thing to do. However, I often do it without actually checking a box in the computer. And so the computer doesn't really know if I checked or not. Most of the time I look at it, and in my practice, I don't practice now, but I practiced for a long time. My medical assistant would ask, and then I would come in and I would look and see what it said down there. And then I would look at the mom or dad and say, so Johnny's not allergic to anything. And sometimes I got the answer like, yeah, it's written down there that they're not allergic, but I would want to know. Anyway, yeah, I'm checked. However, the electronic health record may not know that because I didn't write it down. And so those are little things that make doctors kind of crazy. And no. So to your point, you know, some of these regulatory hurdles, such as if you're licensed to practice in one state, you cannot in any way practice in another, even virtually, seem to be falling, thank God. Now, temporarily, your contention is that they're going to be difficult to bring back. I think you're right. And I think that's great. It's the same thing around privacy. There's a lot of, we all want our records to be maintained in a private way. We're all
absolutely
healthcare, like no matter who you are, you get healthcare. And so whether you're a doctor or a patient, like we all want our private records to be private. That said, there are crazy requirements in the United States, or some of them are not so, the requirements may not be crazy, but the hospital we work for might interpret them in a, you know, in a very legal way so that it's, you know, it's impossible to, you know, share information the way you want. Some of that is also falling by the wayside because of this pandemic. You know, we don't have time to make sure that we have the I's dotted and the T's crossed in order to talk to the uncle who's coming in to see the patient. It's either get information from that guy or the patient's not going to do well. And so some of those restrictions are being relaxed. And I'm with you that this might be, it's hard to see anything positive coming from this, but that might be one of the positives that some of these ridiculous, and again, let me say, lots of regulations make sense, but some of them don't. They seem to be protecting the people that created them, regulators and certain kinds of lawyers, and they don't really seem to make sense for the vast majority of patient interactions. And I say good riddance to those if we can get rid of them permanently, and the country will be better, and you know, doctors will be able to concentrate more on taking care of patients and less on checking boxes that say they've checked the allergies.
So I agree with you. And you know, that aspect to this sort of removal, it's almost that this has focused the mind to establish what's good and positive. And we get to that very quickly because we're also pressured, or that my clinical colleagues and the folks working on the front line are so pressured that they just, it doesn't matter what the regulations say. So there's really an opportunity to cut that away. And I have such a hard time imagining somebody going, right, okay, pandemic over, we're going to reinstall all these rules. And not just in healthcare, you know, there's some other good examples of some of that where, you know, the internet companies have opened up the taps to say, well, we're not going to put a cap on people's internet access because everybody's been sent home. Well, it didn't cost them anything to do that. That capacity was there. It was just a means of adding additional cost to your access. So I think it's going to be hard to walk it back. So for me, you know, I agree with you. It's difficult to sort of find the positive, but I think it's important. I always akin this to having an elastic band around my wrist, and it's like I'm constantly snapping. That's what COVID-19 does to me, and I have to keep snapping back and find those positives. So I know we've spent the duration of this talking about it. We had some other things to talk about, but I'm not surprised it's sort of front and center. We didn't get to some of the things I wanted to. We'll maybe do that the next time. But as always, it remains for me to thank you for joining me. It's always a pleasure to hear your thoughts and get your insights to what's going on each and every time, Craig. So thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Be safe and stay 6 feet away.
Thank you for joining me. This is Dr. Nick, the incrementalist and a whiskey librarian. And I want to thank HP for sponsoring today's episode. You can learn more about HP and their Healthcare Edition products that were designed with clinicians in mind to streamline patient care and optimize clinical workflows at hp.com/go/healthcare/US.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, TheIncrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.